From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Richmond, California.
San Jose.
Union City.
Eastside. Jackson.
I'm from the Campbell area.
Coming up, how a local Syrian engineer is using crowdfunding to help his home country.
When I sit down to work on this project, it's the thing I enjoy the most. I feel there is an outcome of what I'm doing. I feel that I'm finally doing something.
Then a multi-ethnic choir comes together to sing classical Arabic standards.
It's a big task and it's a big job to teach someone who completely has no clue about the language to start from zero.
And we meet a group of friends turned business owners trying to keep the art of hat making alive.
No one's head is the same shape. It's like a snowflake or a fingerprint.
Hats off to that. It's Cross Currents. The conflict in Syria has been raging on for 3 years now.
As fighting rages in Syria, with more reports of barrel bombs being used, rifts within rebel ranks are becoming increasingly deadly. Britain has accused.
While other Arab countries witnessed the Arab Spring, Syria's spring hasn't happened yet. The government is shelling territory held by rebels, the Free Syrian Army, and it's gotten so messy with other militant groups infiltrating the country that it's a completely chaotic situation now. Some Syrians, including Syrian Americans, have lost hope in any political process to solve the crisis and have found other ways to help their country from right here in the Bay Area. Zaid Al-Humsi is one of them. He's a computer engineer in San Francisco's financial district, born and raised in Syria, and came to the U.S. 7 years ago to go to school. Al-Humsi's family is still back in Syria. He says he's frustrated by what he calls the inaction of world powers to help his country. He started to go to protests and became an online activist, signing petitions and spreading the message of the revolution. Then one day, he says, he realized that all that wasn't creating change on the ground in Syria. So Al-Humsi started a project called the 5% Movement, an online crowdfunding platform that funds humanitarian projects in the hardest hit areas. Zaid Al-Humsi joined me by Skype, and I asked him to tell me about making the turn from an activist into a humanitarian.
The main reason is, honestly, is because I felt the political work is not gaining anything. So my turning into humanitarian work came out of a frustration at the U.S. and other Western government, and out of disappointment that nothing is going to happen, in my opinion, at least in the political arena.
Okay, so now tell me about what you did and what you formed.
So a bunch of Syrian Americans, mostly in the Bay Area, and myself, we saw that there's a huge humanitarian need. So now we have about 3 million refugees. We have about 7 million internally dislocated people inside of Syria. And we have liberated areas that are under constant shelling, and they are lacking the most basic need of infrastructure. And at the same time, we saw that there's a lot of people, there's a lot of activists working on the ground inside of Syria on like development projects. And on the other hand, you have a lot of people who want to help the Syrian cause, but they can't get to those activists. So basically, we started a movement called the 5% Movement. And what we do is we get in touch with people on the ground inside of Syria working on projects, and we post their project on the 5% Movement website, and we allow anyone who wants to help the Syrian cause to donate their time or money to get this project to help with these projects. So, for example, one project we have is solar panels for the Ghouta neighborhood of in the suburbs of Damascus. And the suburbs of Damascus are lacking electricity. There's absolutely no electricity. What people do is they use generators, which is very costly because of the price of diesel. So now people are thinking of ways, of alternative ways to generate energy. One of those ideas is a guy working on solar panels in order to generate power for the Ghouta neighborhood. So this project, for example, gets listed on the 5% Movement website. They list what they need in terms of monetary contribution, and they also list what they need in terms of expertise contribution. And now on our end, we go on the website and we browse the project. If we like this project in particular, we can donate money to it. Or if we find out that we have the expertise that the project manager is asking for, we can donate our time to help the project activist. And there is a project management system on the website basically to connect the two and provide monitoring over the implementation of the project.
What are you anticipating in terms of challenges, and how do you prepare for that?
Syrians feel the outcome of this revolution is not in our hands anymore. We feel that this whole thing is now in the hands of big powers. So Syrians have been frustrated. Basically, they gradually backed off and they stopped supporting the revolution. They stopped being active. The main challenge, we think, is it's going to take a lot of work to convince Syrians and non-Syrians also that this revolution, it's still going on. We still have a role in this revolution that we can fulfill, and we can't just back off basically and keep watching what's going on the ground without doing anything. So that's the main challenge. The other challenge is there is a lot of trust issues, because you know, a lot of people don't trust, if they donate their money, that it will basically get delivered to the final beneficiary. And I think it's going to take a lot of effort to convince those people that this is different. And it is actually different, because we are providing a project management system. Unlike other organizations, when you donate on the 5% movement, you have a project management system where you get put in touch directly with the project activist, and you have full transparency on watching the progress and the implementation of the project and requesting any information from the project manager and also from the 5% ambassador for this particular project.
So here you are all the way over here in California, in the Bay Area, near Silicon Valley. You know, I would think that many people would be here and kind of sad for their country, and that's it. But you chose to do something. How do you feel about what you're doing?
I feel great, actually. When I sit down to work on this project, it's the thing I enjoy the most. I feel there is an outcome of what I'm doing. I feel that I'm finally doing something. And basically, I mean, what I tell to those people is we spend a lot of time, especially Syrians, we spend a lot of time in what we think is revolutionizing. So for the past 2 years, I spent countless number of hours watching YouTube videos and following revolution pages, liking those links, liking these videos and sharing them with my friends. And after a while, I figured out that this is not active revolutionizing. This is basically just watching from far away and not doing anything. So now, at least what it made me feel is that it makes me feel, you know, relatively part of the revolution. Of course, I can't say I'm part of this revolution when I compare what I'm doing to what the people on the inside are doing. But at least it gave me some sort of feeling that I'm being active, I'm helping in some way. And the point of this whole platform is to give that same feeling to everyone who uses the platform. We want to give you the feeling that you are actively involved in this revolution, that you are actively involved in the Syrian cause. And the only way we think to get this feeling is by being actually involved, by providing your time, by working with activists, by feeling that you are actually working with a team on the ground inside of Syria.
When I hear the news from Syria, it's extremely sad and frustrating. You sound so hopeful. Where do you get that hope from?
I get the hope from the people I talk to on the ground. Believe me when I tell you that people on the inside are a lot more hopeful than Syrians on the outside. The Syrians I talk to on the outside of Syria, the people I talk to in the U.S., basically are very frustrated. Talking to them kills all the hope in me. On the other hand, whenever I talk and communicate to those activists inside of Syria in the liberated areas, the amount of hope they have is basically what keeps me going. It's basically what keeps me working on this project and the ideas that they're working on. I mean, when you see someone on one project that we got a proposal for is called the Integrity Bus. So this activist called Rezan Ghazali, what she does is she goes on a bus with a projector and a computer, and she goes from school to school in the liberated areas. She goes to damaged schools where refugees live, and she just show videos, basically, Disneyland videos of, like Disney videos of to those children, and she revives the hope in them. So honestly, when you see someone under constant shelling, when you see someone who's forgetting all that's happening and focusing on creative ideas like this, you feel ashamed to be not hopeful, and we are all the way out here, basically.
That's Zayd Al-Humsi, founder of the 5% Movement, an online crowdfunding platform that funds humanitarian projects in Syria. If you'd like to help, we have the link online at kalw.org. Just click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. While Syria struggles to find its way, here in the Bay Area, Syrian Americans are crowdfunding projects, organizing protests, and singing. The Arabic music ensemble Aswat, which means voices in Arabic, is based in San Francisco and plays classical Arabic standards in concerts around the Bay Area. And you don't have to know the language to participate. Non-Arabic-speaking Americans make up half the choir members and musicians. And that's part of the mission, to spread a love for Arabic music that transcends linguistic and cultural boundaries. I visited a rehearsal of Aswat and sat down with former musical director Wa'il Qaqish in this piece from our archives. To join Aswat, you don't have to be Arab. You don't have to speak Arabic. So how can someone who doesn't know a word of Arabic end up singing, you know, classical Arabic poetry that's often difficult even for native Arabic speakers? How does that happen? What's that experience like?
It's a big task and it's a big job to teach someone who completely has no clue about the language to start from zero, of pronouncing certain sounds that are strange to them. Sometimes it takes up to 2 hours, maybe 3 hours, just to go over the lyrics, read them a few times, and have these people read back. And then through listening tapes and CDs, and then eventually start singing the melodies. And the thing is, it's not just the language, it's the melodies that also, the moods that they sing with these half flats and half sharps, which is something does not exist in Western music. But still, you know, they make sure that, you know, the sounds are repeated many, many times till they learn them.
Of course, I'm stressing the kh, you know, just so you could hear it. Khayif yihsiduki.
Khayif yihsiduki.
And then here,
what's unique about your ensemble is that you don't play contemporary Arab music. You go back in history and dive into old Arabic poetry. What kind of poetry do you choose?
We go back to the 7th, 8th century, where some people refer to as Andalusian music or Andalusian. And that's basically when Arabic music went to a different phase from singing the old traditional poetry or qasida to a new style of mixing North African with Arabic, with Spanish, and creating this new style, what they call muwashah or muwashahat. And since then, it became the traditional and the classical form of Arabic music. And that's something we want to focus on and bring back.
Some instruments in the pieces that you play may sound familiar to an American audience. There are violins, there's a cello, but some are classical Arabic instruments. Can you explain some of them? For instance, you have one right next to you there. What is that called, and where did it originate?
Okay, this one called the oud. Oud means wood, and this instrument is made of wood, and it's very similar to the guitar. Some tuning. And historically, ethnic music colleges believe that, you know, Arab musicians traveled with this instrument to North Africa and eventually to Spain. And it was copied in one point to a lute or the lute. And that's where the European lute came from, in a way. They're very similar in somehow in the tuning, except the body, the shape of the oud is like a pearl shape, and it has a fat body on the back to resonate more bass, more sound.
This kind of effort possibly creates a bridge between the American community here and society and the Arab culture back home, when the Arab world might be misunderstood at this time. Do you feel that element is there, or are you just having fun here?
Well, it's not about fun. You know, fun is part of the mission, but I would think of this kind of groups, it's more about education, about bringing something new and sharing this new information with people who don't get informed. And I think music and art is the best source to bring about our beautiful culture to people. More people, you know, emphasize that, you know, this is one of the best music that I ever listened to. It has something in it, and it's for them to discover.
Aswat's next major concert is in June. It's called Aleppo Live and will feature traditional music from Syria, led by Syrian maestro Fethi El-Jarrah. And if you want to be part of that performance and train with them, you can find rehearsal details at kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. You might not be too worried about bundling up this week, as the Bay Area is getting some record-high temperatures. But since San Francisco's beginning, one winter warmer has been worn for function and fashion. Back in the early 20th century, San Francisco's streets were often a sea of hats. Rounded bowlers and pork pies, creased fedoras, tall top hats, wide-brimmed ladies' hats ornamented with flowers and birds. Today, though, the hat's popularity is a shadow of what it once was. And local hatters and milliners that once ran thriving businesses from their trade have all but disappeared. If you do see hats milling about town these days, most likely they're mass-produced in factories overseas. But there's at least one place where the local hat-making tradition carries on, behind a nearly 100-year-old storefront in the Richmond District. In this story from our archives, KALW's Ali Budner takes us to Paul's Hat Works, an old-fashioned men's hat shop, to meet the four young women who've taken up this almost forgotten trade.
When you walk into Paul's Hat Works, it's a bit like stepping back in time. The shop feels well-kept, warm, and decidedly old-fashioned, with wood counters and glass cases. There's an ornate yet functional metal cash register, an old record player, framed black and white pictures of people wearing hats, stacks of vintage hat boxes, and hats of every style hanging from brass hooks.
Do you want to try it on? Oh, yeah, the bow, actually. That's a custom bow, too.
Oh, it looks great.
My name's Kirsten Hove, and I'm wearing a black fedora with a short, curled brim.
Kirsten is co-owner of Paul's Hat Works, which dates back to 1918. All the previous owners have been men, none of them named Paul, but as of 2009, this San Francisco institution has been run collectively by four women in their 20s. The friends-turned-co-workers make a good team. They each fulfill their own niche in their quest to bring back the hat.
So why are we bringing the hat back? Well, I think the hat is just as necessary as a pair of shoes. So I think it's a functional item first and foremost. My name is Olivia Griffin, and I'm wearing an Optimo.
Olivia and her three business partners are all wearing hats, each made right there in the shop. Abby Dwelly is another one of the hat makers.
I'm wearing a fedora.
And last but not least,
my name is Wendy Hawkins. I am a hat maker, and I'm wearing a bowler hat.
Someone joked once that it was called hatitude, so we always say that, like, the way in which you wear your hat.
Full house on Sunday.
A customer to Paul's Hat Works has just walked in the door to pick up an order, a refurbished hat that belonged to his late father.
He passed away 20 years ago, so I just found it in the old tack room, and I thought, oh, where do you have this hat? And looked at it, and got the address up here, came up, wondered if they could do something with it. They said, oh, sure.
That's Urban Bernardo.
From Hanford, California. That's way down in Kings County. No hat shops down there.
Kirsten retrieves Urban's refurbished felt hat from a sliding cabinet behind the counter.
This was originally something that we would call like an open telescope or a loose pork pie.
Kirsten and her partners are dedicated to bringing back the old styles of hats, ones that used to be as common as today's baseball cap. Olivia says old-fashioned hats like the pork pie disappeared from fashion 40 to 50 years ago.
And there's a lot of theories as to why. JFK didn't wear a hat to the inauguration, and that was like a big deal, because before that, everyone else had. He left it in the car, apparently, and the hatting company that made his hat were furious.
Another hypothesis? Cars.
It's hard to wear a hat in a car, so the car thing is part of it.
Or?
In my opinion, hair kind of abolished the hats, and we've joked about like picketing outside of hair salons like and stuff like that.
Whatever the cause, people just don't wear hats like they used to. So you might ask yourself, why would anyone choose this line of business today? Well, when the women of Paul's Hat Works tell their story, they make it sound like it was a matter of fate. But, oddly enough, when they purchased the shop, none of the women knew how to make hats.
So it's kind of scary to buy a business learning to do something that, or buying a business and not knowing how to do what it is that you're going to be doing. So, but a lot of us had a background in textiles, and Wendy had a background in running a business, and so it ended up being less scary than we thought.
For 6 months, the four women took a crash course in hat making with their predecessor, who'd run the shop for 30 years. Everything in the shop came with it. And that's really important because
you have to have very specific tools to make hats, and they're tools that aren't made anymore, which is part of why it's such a special and dying art. Like, you can't go to school to become a hatter because the tools just don't exist and the people don't know how to do it anymore.
Making a new hat is a highly customized process. When designing a new hat for a customer, they use an ancient contraption called a conformature. It looks like a metal top hat with levers and knobs all around it. It measures the precise shape and size of a head.
People often are like, oh, it looks like a medieval torture device. But then they're like, oh, that feels kind of nice. It's like a little bit of a head massage.
It's cold and it's very relaxing.
Kendon Anderson is a customer here. He's purchasing an Optimo, a hat with a thin raised spine down the center. Wendy removes a paper card with holes punched out from the conformature to reveal the shape of Kendon's head.
No one's head is the same shape. It's like a snowflake or a fingerprint.
The workshop, a tiny but neat room just behind the storefront, is where the hat really starts to take shape.
Hats, before they're hats, we call them bodies. You can also call them raw bodies or blanks, but we usually refer to them as bodies, which means before they have a shape in them. Basically, hats are made with steam. Like, steam is what makes a hat. It gives its shape. And then wooden blocks. Like, those are the two main tools.
Next, the hatters bind the brim and stitch in a lining. They can adorn the hat with ribbon and feathers, and voila! It's a bowler, an Optimo, a top hat, pork pie, Panama, or a fedora.
The fedora is the most popular, most common, looks good on almost every single person. The fedora is a gateway hat. Once you get the fedora, then you want to try a bowler, then you want to try a pork pie, then you want to try something else. So I think that it's the gateway hat to having a lot more hats.
Beware the gateway hat. It could easily turn into a pricey habit. The cheapest new hat from Paul's Hat Works is $250, and some are as high as $2,000. Now, that might seem over the top when you consider you could get a similar-looking hat for less than $100 at any store on the street today. But consider Wendy's approach.
I do basic math with people at the register. I'm like, how much did you spend on your laptop, on your cell phone, on your car? How long will that last you? 2 years, 5 years, 10 years if you're lucky and you don't drive that often? This hat will last you 80 to 150 years. So yes, it's $600, but divide that over how many times you'll wear it, over your lifetime, and then it's an heirloom for your family, and that's priceless.
So what's their vision for the future?
This is the groundbreaking for the Midwinter's Fair in Golden Gate Park, August 24th, 1893. And the only man in the whole photograph not wearing a hat is the mayor, who took off his hat to make a speech. And that's our goal. That's our goal, is to have everybody in a hat.
And after spending some time with the women of Paul's Hat Works, I have a feeling they could make it happen. If these merry hat makers have their way, they'll be bringing back not only hats, but also an appreciation for what is handmade, with heart, and of course, hattitude. For Cross Currents, I'm Allie Budner.
Paul's Hat Shop is still going strong. They've even opened up a new shop in Louisville, Kentucky. So keep an eye out for them at the next Kentucky Derby. And that's it for today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes David Boyer, Jeremy Dalmas, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Pfeffer, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Mary Willis. Today's show is produced by Audrey Dilling and engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. This is Melody Walker with Jacob Groupman. They like to call their sound Americali. That's Americana music with a California sound. You can define their sound for yourself when Melody and Jacob take to the stage at the Mildred Owen Concert Hall in Pacifica this Saturday night. Show starts at 7:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.